Today we'll be talking with Dr. Debbie Lee DeStefano about Southeast Spanish for the Health Professions minor, and later Dr. Michael Cobb will tell us about the university being selected as a dark sky site and human light pollution. But we begin with Dr. Quantella Noto from Southeast Hospitality Management Program to tell us about hawk sauce. We're starting hot, Quantella.
Very good on a cold day.
Yeah, good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about hawk sauce and how it all started.
Well, it was a class project, so I teach HM390, Hospitality Sales and Marketing, and I wanted to do something a little different. We had previously done marketing plans for businesses in the community, and I just decided it was end of the last semester, winter, I'm watching football, I'm eating hot sauce, and thought, why not do this for the class? So before I introduced it to the class, I discussed using the Red Hawk label and image with our marketing department and then later the athletic department because I thought we needed a signature sauce, a signature product. Okay. And so I started thinking about that before we went to class and thought hot sauce would be a good idea.
I read that, so hot sauce is the number one condiment now? Is that, or up there at least?
Up there. Up there, yes, it has surpassed ketchup, and is up there with salsa.
I was surprised by that.
Are you?
But I don't keep up with those things, and I know that you do.
Yes, I have 7 or 8 bottles of hot sauce in my house.
So I read about the Fresno pepper.
Yes.
How did you find this pepper?
Well, it's a pepper that I really like. I'm not familiar to this area. And the way we started this is the students, I said, well, we have to get recipes first, right? So the students sourced some recipes. One of the recipes called for cayenne or Fresno chili peppers. And I knew that pepper was very different and very interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the discussion in marketing is differentiating a product. So I knew that if we used a Fresno chili pepper, we would differentiate this hot sauce. So I had the students look at that. We sourced it from California initially. Mm-hmm. And in keeping in line with something really red, I knew that chili pepper would hold up to the cooking process. So it's just a very different and unique pepper.
How hot is it?
Not very. I would say we're going to not put it on the real heat scale, but a 1 to 10 scale, it's a 5 or 6. It actually sweetens a little over time, so in the bottle it's going to get a little sweeter.
I read that when during the cooking process, I guess the longer, so it starts out sweet, but if it sets longer, does it get hotter as it sets in the
pot? As any perishable product, it sort of depends on what the soil at the time, you know, mm-hmm. the weather. It can be like a grape, it just have some variations, so it is going to change. I've had some people say they thought it was sweeter over time. Hmm. I've had some people say they thought it was hotter.
I guess everybody's palate.
Everybody's palate is different.
What did the students think about this, as opposed to doing a marketing plan to actually doing this, taking this idea from idea to fruition? What was that like?
Well, you know, at first they said sure. You know, I mean, I'm the professor in class. I said, "Do you want to do hot sauce?" They said sure. They have acknowledged that they didn't expect it to go this far. We started out just a few samples. We had them in mason jars. Of course, as I stated before, I went to our dean, asked for some funding to get it started. He said, sure, it sounded like a good project. And so we did it. A couple of students enjoyed it more than others initially. But as with anything, I think once they saw success, everyone was really into it. And so we turned it into where I wanted the students to do all aspects of this, the labeling, the bottling, the sourcing. We have a story for it. We actually have a domain name for a website, so for the future we can do that.
Okay.
So we really took it just beyond the bottling, but to construct a business that we could use moving forward.
And there was some collaboration with some other
Yes.
departments.
So we collaborated with Dr. Steve Stovall. He has a entrepreneurship class, and they do projects as well, and so I thought, well, maybe just to have some other eyes and take a look at it. It was his class that actually came up with the name Hawk Sauce. We were going to call it Rowdy Sauce, and one of them said Hawk Sauce, and all of a sudden the students just said that was a drop the mic moment.
Yeah.
And it became that. And then Charlotte Cervantes in our nutrition department was with us in the kitchen when we made this. She was able to give us what would be close to an FDA-approved label so that the labeling would meet all of those requirements.
So there's a lot that went into this.
There's a lot that went into this, yes. And we did it fairly quickly, you know, within a semester. We just had to stay focused.
And you started it in spring.
We started it in spring, yes.
And so this
2018.
And this fall, I guess you've probably made more bottles. This is the biggest production so far this
well,
fall, or not?
Yes. So we had a request from admissions department initially for 125 bottles, which blew our minds. If you're an entrepreneur and you're doing a startup, to get an order that big is amazing.
Yeah.
We could not fill that order, of course. And then this summer, they asked for 750 bottles, possibly to give as gifts.
Wow.
In their recruiting efforts. And then we realized we might actually have something. So we ordered 150 pounds of peppers this time. Prepped peppers on a Monday, made the sauce on Tuesday, and had an assembly line process of bottling on Thursday. That got us close to 400 bottles. So what we're doing is perfecting it. You know, we're bringing our costs down. I got a new supplier for the bottles, a new supplier for the peppers, and now a process where we pay the students this
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
Minimum wage. And so what we did was get to where we could scale it up. And now we know how we can do 400 bottles. We'll see where it goes from there.
You got about a minute and a half. So
okay.
What's next?
More sauce.
Just more?
We have the class next spring. I had a student say to me, I'm enrolled in your Hawk Sauce class. I said, it's called sales and marketing, but calling it the Hawk Sauce class. So I have some ideas to keep it moving. We did some products last time. We didn't roll all of those out. We may roll out another product next semester.
You got to keep some tricks up your sleeve.
We
right
do.
For later.
We do.
Well, good luck with the project.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're joined now by Dr. Debbie Lee DeStefano from Southeast Department of Communication Studies and Modern Languages. She's here to tell us more about the university's Spanish for the Health Professions minor and how it is preparing students to be culturally competent. Debbie, welcome to the program. Well,
thank you so much for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about this program and maybe sort of how it came about.
Well, the original discussion started with a discussion I had with Professor Brooke Clubs, who's the Director of Health Communication at mm-hmm. Southeast, and she and I did a presentation together on campus about the need to include linguistically and culturally competent healthcare in the healthcare system. This combined also with with previous Governor Jay Nixon and current Governor Parsons' idea that we, as an institution of public education, need to look at workforce development. And so I started pondering, how can I get people to understand that Spanish is very vital in our social setting in the United States and in Southeast Missouri? And this kind of came up because through this conversation with Brooke and the idea of how do we make our students who are studying any type of health profession become more linguistically and culturally competent, I started thinking, why don't we create a series of courses that eventually became a minor in Spanish for Health Professions?
Yeah, and I guess there was a need for it not only here, but just all across the country. I mean, this is something that's really desperately needed, right?
It is, exactly. Whenever we think of portability of degrees, portability of skills, people may think that in Southeast Missouri, we don't have a lot of people that need to be attended to, but we do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have 2%, I think, in Cape County, I think in the state of Missouri, it's 4%, but we have pockets in different areas. So if you go to Dunklin County, 6% of Dunklin County is of Hispanic origin. If you go to Southwest Missouri, you have larger populations, up to 20% in some counties.
Wow.
So people don't understand that just within the state of Missouri, you don't have to go to St. Louis and Kansas City. There are rural areas that are in need of this type of training. And so, but if you want to leave the borders of Missouri, Illinois, many people do not know, is the fifth largest state with Hispanic origin in the United States. So, you know, you just go next door and you're going to be able to
yeah.
find a place that you could use your degree and to use these skills.
And I guess the situation, you don't want someone who speaks Spanish to go to a hospital and no one can understand what they're saying to them and they're in need of care. And this is a way to sort of make sure that doesn't happen, right?
Exactly. We understand that our healthcare system does have the iPad system, or they have where you can call for an mm-hmm. interpreter. But if you look at the Office of Minority Health from the United States, from the federal office, that is on the low list of preferable means of interpretation. It's better to have bilingual professionals. And bilingual professionals, any of our students could take the exam and be call themselves bilingual professionals as long as they can pass the certification test. After that, then you have certified interpreters, and then we get into the, are we going to use an iPad? Are we going to use a telephone?
Okay. And there's a part of this course is, I think they travel into, right?
They, yes, they do.
Because it's not just knowing the language, but it's understanding the culture,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
About that a little bit.
The cultural aspect is interesting. And I even use, you know, Missouri. I'm from Donovan. And my cultural background in Donovan as a white female is different from the cultural background of a white female in St. Louis. So just culturally, even working within the state, there's going to be difference because of regions. And then when you're adding on another area of origin, when you're coming from outside the United States, or and then dealing with gender, et cetera, it's necessary to understand those nuances of care. One of the stories that Brooke and I mentioned in our presentation is that there was a gentleman who is now quadriplegic because somebody misinterpreted a word, and the hospital assumed he had alcohol poisoning, but it wasn't that. And so, and essentially, if it turned out it wasn't alcohol poisoning, it was something else, but it was because it was a really bad interpretation. And so there are ramifications if something is not interpreted correctly.
So the students will not only learn the language, but do they travel? Where do they go abroad? Is there certain places that they travel to?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Exactly. So to add on to the cultural aspect, currently, so what I look for, students ask me, why do we have to study abroad? I say, because you need to know what it means to be the different person in an environment.
Okay.
So when we go, so for example, the two health trips, the one I took last May and the one I'm going to do this current May, are to Ecuador. We have an exchange partner there, the University of the Americas. They have a medical school. They have doctors who are excellent speakers when it comes to the idea of community health. And so we have lectures with those professors. They teach my students how to do a good medical interview at their level in Spanish. And then we also go to community clinics. So we go to small clinics and small towns around the city. We go to big hospitals, and we also go into the Amazon. So we see what is it when you're working with a largely indigenous population, not the mestizo population that you're going to get in the city of Quito.
Big difference, I would imagine.
It was. The most interesting, I think, visit that really struck my students was we went to a midwife clinic. Now, we weren't seeing someone give birth, but they have this demonstration prepared to show how this indigenous group of women work as midwives with their patients. And it's very eye-opening just to see how different people view health, how different people discuss health, and then the linguistic and cultural aspects that come into that.
Because there's expectations within the different communities, and I guess you have to be sensitive and aware of that, and training and going and asking questions is the only way to really prepare yourself, right?
Exactly. And to understand, you know, that the grammar, knowing the vocabulary is the most important part, but then having that empathy. I work with Dr. Linda Garner quite a bit on campus as well, and she and I started teaching a community health worker course together. And the concept of cultural humility, which I prefer over cultural competence, is, I think, a better term, because you never stop. It's always a learning. It's always a reflection on who you are as a person and your own biases as you're working. And understand that when I'm working with a patient in whatever language I'm working in, it's my job to make sure that they're being taken care of and to understand their background, not to impose my background on them. And that's what I hope my students get from this type of experience.
Cultural humility.
Mm-hmm.
What has the response been from students so far? I know it's early. But.
It's early. You know, we started teaching Spanish one. I was just going over my head earlier. Back in 2016, Zach Kaler was the first person to really finish all the classes. He didn't do the exit exam, so he didn't graduate with the minor. But at this point, students have loved it because it's not for every student, because you have to want to study a language and you have to be willing to get into that discussion of culture and who you are as a practitioner. And the idea of cultural humility is when you've got to kind of let go that, yes, I'm the doctor, but I'm not the person with power. The patient knows their background much better than I do. And that's really hard for some people to get over.
To get there, yeah. Well, thank you very much for telling us all about this. This is really exciting.
Great. Thank you so much.
Southeast has been selected as a dark sky site, and Dr. Michael Cobb from the Department of Physics is here to tell us more about it. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So when I first saw this, I thought of dark sky and I thought of the weather app. And so I did a little reading and realized that is not what this is about. So tell us what this dark sky site is about, and a little bit about light pollution, I think is what we're going to get to.
Well, there's an international organization, the International Dark Sky, and we now have a Missouri chapter of that. And the main purpose is one of awareness. Obviously, we're talking about it, so that helps. I'm an astronomer, and so to me, dark skies mean how many stars can you see? And if you go to St. Louis, you might see a couple. If you come here to Cape, you might find a handful. But if you go out to a nice dark site, you'll see hundreds, if not thousands. Yeah. So it's all about awareness, and we are finding out that light affects many other things besides astronomers. And so it's a very interesting area of research.
And so I think Truman State is the one that's doing this, I guess, this research project. But we're part of that now because we have this sky quality meter, I guess it's called here, right?
That's right. So Truman is the lead in the organization. They got it together and got some funding and stuff. And they asked for applications. And so filled out an application, mm-hmm. and we got selected. And so they're looking for a variety of different sites, some in metropolitan areas, some in our state parks, some in our smaller cities. And so they're trying to sample a range of different locations in the state.
So what is this sky quality meter? What does it do?
Yeah. So it's a single channel. It looks at about a 20-degree cone straight up. It takes data every 5 minutes and then stores that on board. And then twice a month, I have to go up, I download the data, and then I'll email it to Truman. And so it just looks straight up and measures how bright the sky is that it sees and collects that data.
So why is this type of information, this data, important for us to find out?
Well, from an astronomer, of course, it's very important. And many cities that are associated with astronomical observatories have instigated very strict light pollution guidelines. And so you can't just have a light bulb out in your backyard. You know, it needs to be shielded and look down the ground and so on mm-hmm. and so on. But like I said, we're also finding physiological effects of light. You know, you're not supposed to do your phone as you're laying there in bed at night, right? Because the light sets off your circadian rhythms. And sports players that travel multiple time zones get their circadian rhythms messed up too, and so they have special lights that they take with them to try to maintain the sequence of their bodies. And even migrating birds get confused with all the bright city lights and stuff, and it kind of disrupts their migration path. So a lot of interesting things having to do with light that affects a lot of other things besides just astronomy.
And not only that, but just the energy consumption, the energy that's wasted by light sometimes that maybe really don't need to be there, right?
Oh, that's correct. Of course, we're doing a lot better now with LEDs. So we started off with incandescent light bulbs, which we're slowly making illegal. And then we converted to fluorescent lights, which are about 10 times more efficient.
Okay.
And then LEDs are 10 times more efficient than fluorescent lights. So we're heading the right direction from an energy consumption point of view.
Well, I watched a video from the International Dark Sky Association. One of the things they noted was because of light pollution, there are some people who've never seen the Milky Way.
It's true. I frequently teach our astronomy class here on campus, and we get many students from St. Louis. The university has a farm out by Gordonville, and we have a trailer out there that we do our night labs. Cool. And that's a fairly dark site, and they're amazed at what you can see. You can see the Milky Way. You can see, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of stars. So, yeah, we consider it a natural resource, an unrenewable natural resource. Yeah. Once you've lost it to bright city lights, very hard to get it back. And so many states actually claim to have a tourist attraction for dark skies. And so finding the dark sites in Missouri might be a touristy thing that we try to promote.
We like to go, my family likes to go camping a lot. We go to Missouri State Parks, yep. And it's always amazing how many more stars you can see when you're out in a park cool. versus being in town. It's like the world opens up in a way.
And, of course, from my point of view, I see this as a historic connection to my predecessors, because every human that's ever lived and had vision, before us anyway, has seen the night sky, mm-hmm. has seen the Milky Way. To me, I look up and I see the moon, and I know everyone else that's ever lived on Earth has looked up and seen that moon as well. And so for me, it just gives me a connection to my heritage, the things that you can see in the sky. And I hate to lose the dark skies and that ability to know that we're in a galaxy called the Milky Way, and we're just one of many of those lights that we see in the sky.
Yeah. The other thing I read about was that with all the lights that are poured in a city at night, sometimes it's hard for drivers to sometimes even see the lines. There's so much light poured on some of the roads, sometimes it's really difficult.
Yeah, why they can't use reflective paint on those stripes, I don't know.
Yeah. So there's a lot of it. So there's a lot of things. It's not just, so you got the health issue, you've got safety while driving, you've got the energy consumption.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that light pollution, I guess, really impacts that people may not think about.
This is true. And so part of this is an awareness thing, and part of this is a research thing as well. And the guy that came down and helped set up the sensor said they've discovered that trees that grow very near bright outdoor lights hold on to their leaves significantly longer than trees that are away from the light. So even those are affected by light.
Is there any implications with climate change related to light at all in any scenario?
Well, I suppose in as much as climate change would be increased clouds, increased humidity in the air, increased dust in the air, so all those kinds of things would affect how bright, how dark the sky is.
What do you think most people think about if you were to talk to them about light pollution? Do you think they would understand what that even meant?
Most probably not. Most probably wouldn't identify it as a pollution. Most willingly put bright lights on their homes. We have lights shining up from the foundation all on the side of the house. We have bridges with lights that shine up, even though they're only illuminating very thin cables, and all that light goes up into the sky. I live out in the county, and I can see the glow from St. Louis from my house out here in Cape Girardeau. So.
Well, Dr. Cobb, thank you for an illuminating discussion.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you.